Hello and welcome to another episode of the PA Path Podcast. This episode is brought to you by the Southern Illinois University Medicine Online Doctor of Medical Science degree, now enrolling for 2025. Today we speak with Dr. Don Diemer, Program Director for the Southern Illinois University PA Program and founder of their DMSC program. Dr. Diemer has been involved in leadership in every aspect of his professional life as a PA. He was a PA with the United States Air Force for 24 years. He is a past president for the Illinois Academy of Physician Assistants, and he was a member of the American Academy of PA's House of Delegates for several years. He currently serves on the Illinois State Medical Board and practices in a rural FQHC. Don, thank you so much for joining us today. We're excited to learn about both your PA program at Southern Illinois University, but also your Doctor of Medical Science program that you offer as well. Before we get into that, though, let's start about you. You've been a PA for a while now, including some time in the Air Force. Thank you for your service. If you could just tell us about your path to becoming a PA first, that would be great.
Yeah, thanks for having me on the show. I'm super excited to be here. I've just been fortunate in my life. I love being a PA. It's a great profession. And the way things have worked out for me is just how they have my whole life. I can't really say that I started out as many of our applicants do now and have all of the things like I really wanted to do this so that I could help people and all of the reasons that you hear over and over. Of course, I wanted that, but I really had no idea what a PA was. I joined the Air Force in 1983 and I became a pharmacy tech. And while working as a pharmacy tech, I got to meet a few of the PAs who worked in the clinic and always had a lot of respect for what they were doing. And they were very collaborative and always seemed happy. You didn't really ever find one who didn't like their job. And that's not common across the board in all health professions. And so my interest grew a little over time. And at some point, I decided that I wanted to be a little bit more involved in the decision-making process. I don't quite know when that happened, but I had started going to school at night when I was enlisted and finished my master's degree. And actually had thoughts of getting out, and I was set to get out of the military. And then Desert Storm came up and they did this thing called stop loss for a time period. Even if it's time for you to get out, you can't get out. And in that meantime, they opened the PA program back up in the Air Force. That was before they had the inter-service PA program. The Air Force program was at Wichita Falls, Texas, and I applied and ended up being an alternate, but then was called later on. And again, fortunate, got into the program. Hardest thing I've ever done, PA school, you all know, is super difficult, but so rewarding. And I did 10 more years working in various capacities in the Air Force. I was in a family practice clinic for a while, and then I got stationed over at Hickam, Hawaii, and I was in charge of sort of their emergency services there. We ran ambulances in and out of there and did a lot of interesting things. Anytime a dignitary was going to land there at what kind of became known a little bit as the gas station or the refueling place for the Pacific, I would always have to know about it because we would need to make sure that ambulances were where they're supposed to be and we had a good egress to get to the main hospital and those type of things. But it was great. And then I've served as the chief of a family practice clinic again after that in the Air Force and just enjoyed all of my time in the Air Force. It was great. I always wanted to teach. That's what my first degree was in. And when it came time for me to retire at Texas Tech, there were a lot of my friends and acquaintances that had went there to be at that PA program. And we called it IPAP North, because it was at Texas Tech, and all of us were in the military. And I spent 5 years there. Some personal and family problems made it where I needed to try to get back closer to home, both my family and my wife's family. And I saw this job opened at Southern Illinois for a program director, and I applied for it. And fortunate again, ended up getting the job. And I've been here 14 years now and just absolutely love it. It's a great program.
I originate from Illinois, and it's my recollection that it was one of the earliest programs in the state, right?
I think probably one of the earliest. 1997 is when it started. So they're
certainly the only state school.
Right. Only one outside of Chicago.
And at SIU also have had a medical school for a long period of time as well.
Yes, just had their 50-year anniversary. I believe it was a couple of years ago. So had a medical school that's been around for quite a while, and they had Dr. Barrows there and got the problem-based learning thing started at the medical school. And then when the PA program started, we just followed suit with that. And I've just tried to stay true to PBL here. I think it's great. I wish I would have had the opportunity to learn that way, but yeah.
So Don, before we dig into the program more, I'm just curious if you could share with our audience, because it's my recollection from my military experience that PAs in the military, especially back in the 90s and 2000s for sure, right, had a level of autonomy that perhaps PAs in the civilian practice didn't see in every state. Reflect back to that autonomy you had as a clinician in your early days as a PA, and compare and contrast it to what we have now as we're seeing the laws change for PAs in the country.
Yeah, I would certainly say that as a rule, there was more autonomy. In my career, you had a supervising or a collaborating physician, but everyone worked in the clinics or in whatever, if they worked in the emergency room or in a specialty clinic or even as a hospitalist, you didn't really have the restraints that would come along with whatever stage had. There was a time when it was required for us to start getting state licenses. That was later on in my career, but you only had to go by federal rule, and there's not many for things that would come up. We could always write for Schedule IIs and even injectable Schedule IIs and the like, and never could do that until a few years ago. We had Schedule IIs, and in Illinois, still there's only topical or oral forms of that. But that's just one example. There were no constraints on the types of referrals or types of services you could order. We have a lot of problem with different insurance companies and such with physical therapy orders, home health orders, and all types of things like that. But in the military, there just wasn't that. And you could be deployed off somewhere and you might be the only medical person there. We got help when we needed it, but you were just as likely to get help from the more seasoned PA who was in the next office than you were to go in and find someone else. A lot of our physicians in the military at that time were GMOs. They hadn't went to a residency yet. So they would get pulled back in. If they were in one of those programs where they were on scholarship, they might get pulled back in after their 4 years of medical school. And so they're just starting fresh too. Of course, you would have some experienced physicians who wanted to stay in and rise up higher into the ranks. But many of the ones that worked with us at the clinic level and the hospital level were right in there with us and trying to learn more and do the best we could for the patients and help each other out. But yeah, the autonomy thing, definitely I didn't feel the restraints that I feel still, even though we're gaining more.
So I'd like to touch on something that you mentioned before, and that is that Southern Illinois University has a medical school. And I think that's something that for our pre-PA listeners, they might not understand some of the benefits that exist for PA programs that are situated in a school with a medical school. So can you talk a little bit about how you feel like your program has been enriched or has benefited from being co-located in an institution with a medical school?
Yes, certainly. I think it's been great. We started out in the medical school, and then they moved to the College of Applied Science and Arts, I believe in the early 2000s, and stayed there until 2012. That was just shortly after I got here, and I really wanted to get back in the medical school. We already collaborated with them on many things, and the training was much more similar. And I just feel that being in a medical school, you have a lot more people in the educational process and in your administrative structure who understand what you need and what you do and are helpful in getting that. Another thing that's been great about working in a medical school and having a dean of the medical school who's really understanding of PAs and respectful of PAs and our department chair is too, is that we've been able to get them to support us not only monetarily, but they advocate for us. They sign on to our PA bills. We have difficulty sometimes with our state medical society when it comes to that. And it's a lot of help when SIU and our medical school realizes that some of the things that we want are to help our patients and also to keep the profession progressive and current. And they're happy to help us with that. Also, I think generally speaking, there's a clinical income in the medical school. And I think a lot of times We have an availability of resources that we're very fortunate to have. We share a lot. We have a program here that's called the Lincoln Scholars Program, and I don't know if you all have ever heard of that before. Several years ago, the medical school here, part of their mission was to provide care to Central and Southern Illinois, and especially in Southern Illinois, it's difficult to recruit physicians. But what this program would do, instead of the medical students going to school here 1 year and then moving to Springfield and then going the other 3 years and then going to a residency somewhere else, the thought was, if you could keep a group of physicians here the entire medical school and then hope that they might match with our residency here, that they'd end up staying here in deep Southern Illinois. And after a lot of work and a lot of review by a lot of people, and I happened to be in on that from a little bit later than the ground up, but early on, comparing curriculums and things, they got to seeing that while the PA curriculum really is very similar, what separates it, maybe some basic science things that we have them do before they get here, and then some, the residency is what, is the thing that separates it. The school is not as different as you might think. And so what they did was, instead of recreating the wheel, is they put 8 medical students in school with the PA students, and they're in class with them, and they do every single thing that they do for the duration of PA schools. A lot of their didactic learning is side by side with the PA students, and if you were in there, you wouldn't know who was who. They work great together. It's been a successful program. We've just graduated our first class. We've had it going for 4 years now, first class of medical students. There's always going to be, 4 years worth of them in the pipeline, but they have graduated and have matched the way that they wanted to. We're going to end up with some of them staying here. We hoped we would. And so it's been a success. And just the interprofessional aspect of it is really went over, and we like it.
Yeah, I think there's a real tangible benefit from students learning interprofessionally, particularly PAs and MDs, because I think it really affords MD students an opportunity to see how similar the training is, at least at the didactic and the clinical levels, and in undergraduate medical education.
Yeah, I've seen that firsthand. They become very close and they depend on each other. They're in their small PBL groups with PA students, and it's a very collaborative environment.
Yeah, that sounds like a really excellent opportunity.
Let's take a quick break for a word from this episode's supporter, the Southern Illinois University Medicine Online Doctor of Medical Science degree. Are you ready to move forward in your career? Enroll in an online Doctor of Medical Science degree with Southern Illinois University Medicine. In 1 year, you can refine your clinical and scholarly skills and become a better advocate and leader. You can earn 37 Category 1 CME credits for your coursework without leaving your job or family behind. Apply today. To learn more, visit the website at siumed.edu/DMSC and register for the virtual information session.
So tell us about SIU's PA program. How long is it? What are you looking for in your applicants? What obviously this sets you apart, what you just talked about, the Lincoln Scholars, but what are some of the other things that you're really proud of about the program?
Our program performance has been good. We're doing something right. We have very low attrition and super high board pass, first time rates, just the things that you look at on the surface like that are really good, and all that's easy to find on our website. But our program is 26 months, so the only overlap is a summer semester, and it's problem-based learning, and we really try to stay true to that. Most of our learning is by problem-based learning. And I may have said this before, but I wished I would have had the opportunity to learn that way. I work still in clinic 1 day a week, and I see the students who go through PBL and ones that don't. And initially, at least, there just is a difference. So we start out the first year, and a day in PA school would look like this. They'd have problem-based learning Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, and just start out every Monday with a chief complaint. And it goes from there. They ask the history questions, the physical exam questions, and get the answers to those. And everything that comes up that day that everybody in the group doesn't understand pretty well becomes what's called a learning issue. And They go home and research that, bring it back on the next PBL session, which would be Wednesday. And they teach it to each other. Then they get their lab results, imaging, all the things that they wanted. Again, everything that comes up, learning issue, they do the same thing, come back Friday, teach it to each other, and then they do their assessment plan, and then it's over, and they start up a new case on Monday. Now, we do have some lectures, and those lectures are on things that maybe have a little bit more complicated theories and such that we might want to make sure that everyone understands those more complicated concepts and has a little bit of a level playing field because they're so different in there. They still study these things in group, but as an example, we have a pharmacology course that's ran by a PharmD. He lectures on that once a week. We have a physiology, a course that's called Clinical Anatomy and Integrated Sciences, and there's a person who lectures once a week in that on the more complicated physiological and pathophysiology processes that may happen, especially in relation to whatever case that they're in. And then we have a subject matter expert who does a case wrap-up Friday afternoon on those cases. And Thursdays, we actually have clinic half a day and cadaver lab half a day. So we start clinic in the first year, which is a little bit different than a lot of programs. But I just think it reinforces the content that they're learning in those PBL groups. You learn something well enough to teach it to yourself and then to others, and then you go out and you maybe see it in clinic right away in the first year. It just solidifies it in your memory. We train other programs to do PBL. We have workshops, and we use novice students from the campus. We don't use PA students to do the mock groups. And I'll have students come up to me on campus and say, oh, you're the program director at the PA program. And I say, yeah. And they go, yeah, we were in that PBL workshop that you did, and I really wish we could learn that way in all of our classes. I still remember everything about appendicitis from 2 years ago from that one day, and I can't remember what I had in my chemistry class yesterday. I'm a believer in it. Now, I didn't understand it at all when I got here. To be honest with you, it's taken me this long, and still there's faculty here who understand it way better. But it's good. In fact, we call the teachers tutors back then. Since then, we've turned around and started calling them facilitators. But when I first got here and I interviewed, I knew so little about it. They're walking me around and saying, oh, you can't meet so-and-so, they're tutoring. You can't meet so-and-so, they're tutoring. And after about four or five people like that, I'm thinking, my goodness, what's going on here if everybody needs to be tutored? But
it made you nervous, sure.
Yeah, but I quickly learned the terminology, but we changed the terminology here so that others would understand it if they were in.
That's good. But, yeah.
That's good. So I was just talking to a student the other day about group projects, and one of the frustrations for this person was having a colleague that was not living up to their obligation to the group. So how do you sort that out on the front end for your applicants to make sure that's the right fit for a PBL model? And how do you assess that as an educator if somebody's life happens, right? And sometimes people aren't able to put in the effort they should.
And so that happens. And we try to screen for that in the interview process. We actually hold a mock PBL group for our applicants on the day that they enter. We get to watch them in group. It's hard, though. You can tell some things from that, and I think it does help. But you have to put yourself in the shoes of the applicant. It might cause someone to be more controlling in a group than they normally would to try to show you that they have knowledge. But we don't really care what knowledge they have as much at that point as we care what type of a group member they're going to be. And sometimes they don't get that. And some of them want to be super polite and let everyone go first and all of that and become a very quiet participant. We think that helps us some, but still not the best way, a one-time shot to learn that. But in the groups, how we take care of that is we're really big on feedback, group feedback. And before PBL starts, we go around the room setting goals, and everyone is supposed to say what is their weakness and what they would try to get better at. And they take those types of learning issues that they want to confront and learn what isn't their specialty, maybe. And that helps a little bit. But the feedback process is great because they go around the room, and I know on the surface this seems like it would be uncomfortable, but it's really not, because they depend on each other for their learning. And if someone's not putting enough anatomy and physiology in their learning issue, because our learning issues are all encompassing. Some programs will do the clinical part of that, and then they'll, in the class, they'll learn the science part or whatever. I see that in some places that we've taught PBL, that's the way they want to do it. But ours is everything. So if they're leaving something out of that, of their learning issues, they get called out by the group and they're told to do it again, and they bring it back until it's right. And pretty soon, by the end of that group, that 8 weeks, because we do eight cases, 8 weeks, then a week of testing, then a week of remediation. That's our units, and there's five in the first year. By the time that comes to a close, or even part of the way through the very first unit, everybody pretty well knows that there's no way for me to get out of pulling my weight in this group. And it just really does become a problem.
So as you're assessing applicants, obviously being a good team player and that application of critical thinking skills in a group type setting are important to you. What else are you looking for your traditional program? What are things that set applicants apart that make them great candidates for SAU?
It's tough. And I know that you all probably know this because of the amount of applicants we get and just how good the applicants are now. I would have no chance of getting in PA school. I don't think.
I think most of us old school folks feel that way.
Yeah. We had 1,400 applicants. And one thing we look for is we do give an advantage to those from rural areas, because that's part of our mission, rural and medically underserved. So there's some points there. And of course, we've got a rubric and we look at their letters of reference. But the bottom line is what this has turned into. They've gotten so good is that people read the mission statement, they do their research on the program, and they fill all of those squares if they can. They give you the extra leg up. And then what ends up separating them on points on the rubric is their GPAs. And they're all so high that we'll have a class of 40 people who they've checked the rural box, they've done great, they've got their experience, they did shadowing, whatever. And what separates them is 3.9 versus a 3.8. It's just the way that it is. So we get the things that we're looking for, but it's not what separates them out. We're still getting 60% of our graduates to work rural and health profession shortage areas, which is super high percentage.
Yeah, that's huge.
Yeah, that's not the only people we take. We've got a lot of applicants from Chicago, and we've all over the place. You know how it is. And we do get some, and they get points for rural and underserved, but they're not the only ones getting in. And somehow, even though research shows where you're from has a lot to do with what type of practice you'll end up doing, if you're from rural, you might do rural. But I don't know if it's the rural rotations and they get out there and end up liking it there, and the people like them, and there's that opportunity, you know, for loan repayment and such, that we end up still getting quite a lot of people to practice that, and we don't have to do anything specific more than that to meet our mission.
Yeah, I would argue that you're probably spot on with the data, right? Because if you have outstanding rotations that illustrate a happy family physician and family practice PA and a meaningful contribution to a community that really has that unique flavor of rural, where you're going to the Piggly Wiggly and you're seeing your patients down the aisle and everybody's happy to see you. I think there's something to be said about that too. I think we learned that from the North Dakota PA school and their outstanding success in rural as well. So that's great. Don, let's talk a little bit about the DMSC. So you've got students who are getting their master's degree as a PA, but you have an option for them to continue on for a doctorate in medical science. And I presume that's also open to all of us PAs around the country.
It's open to all NCPA certified PAs. Yeah, our DMSC is 1 year. It's 37 semester hours, 17 of which is a practicum. And we have an education track and a clinical track. The courses are designed to make not just a better clinician in the way of, we're not teaching medicine so much, but it's a lot of the softer skills, and then it's things that will definitely help you be a better practitioner, though, I feel. Research, they're going to be better at being able to do research and evaluate research. We learn a lot about disaster response, global medicine. And then we have a lot of twist on rural and medically underserved because that's our mission. We still do it in the DMSC. So we learn a lot about how to put what we can learn about social determinants of health and available resources and things into practice. And a lot of our graduates tell us that's been some of the most helpful things that they've been able to connect with in their practices and to provide better overall holistic type care for their patients. Learn a lot about law, healthcare law, which is obviously going to be helpful. And then we try to help them navigate advocacy a lot better. We need that. That's something that's been difficult in the PA profession is having enough people that wanted to and having enough people that would and being on the same page with each other enough to advocate for things that would help our profession and our patients. And we try to instill that in the DMSC students, at least give them the tools to effectively do that.
Yeah, I think that's something that just a little bit of education around advocacy can make a huge difference in someone's confidence in moving forward with advocacy activities, because I think it's a very intimidating thing when you don't know much about it. And it seems probably bigger and scarier than it actually is until you learn a little bit about it. So I feel like some advocacy training can really have huge returns, because I think just a little boost in confidence around advocacy can really make a difference in somebody's ability to go forward and use their voice and do really great things.
Oh, yeah. So spot on with that for sure.
Don, this has been fantastic learning a lot about SIU and about your path to becoming a PA. We always like to, before we close, give our guests an opportunity to pitch in with anything else that you'd like to have our listeners know, or if you have any sage advice for pre-PA students or PA educators or anything else that we didn't cover that you wanted to chat about today.
Well, for those groups that you mentioned, for the pre-PAs or the PA wannabes, I would say to start early. There's almost no room from what I've seen for that first year mess up that I know that I did back in the day, and many of us did, because if all things being equal and you have to separate because of grades, then that's going to be difficult. But I would say it's a great profession and to keep going with that. And for teachers, if you can, I would say one of the things that's helped me and has been important for me is to keep practicing if you can. If you can find a way to do that, I think staying current, and also students who know you're in practice still just seem to have a different level of respect for what you say, if it's in terms of medicine. And I know when you become a program director and become a dean, some of you all are in higher positions within our organizations, sometimes it's easy for this thing to become more like running a business. I have found myself there, especially since starting and now having two programs running at the same time and three starts for the DMSC. There just becomes so many things that are not medical and are away from the actual teaching of students that makes it difficult. So I would say if you're going to be in PA education, do your best to try to hold on to those things as much as you can that are, you still have to do a good job on the business side, but it can easily turn into that being all there is to it.
Don, thank you again for your time and for your insights on this. It's been really great to get you on, and get you on another time, maybe perhaps in the future, we can talk more about leadership and your work with the medical board and some of the things that you've done at the academy. But congrats on great work at SIU.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it. Thank you all for all you do.
We want to thank our guest, Dr. Don Deemer, for his time and insights into the Southern Illinois University PA program and their Doctor of Medical Science program. It's great to hear about the innovative things happening in Carbondale, Illinois. We also want to extend a special thank you to the Southern Illinois University Medicine Online Doctor of Medical Science degree for their support of this podcast. Visit siumed.edu/DMSC to learn more and apply. Tune in next time as we speak with the leaders of our profession, both nationally and worldwide.